The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Greetings, everyone, and welcome to That's a Laugh. I'm Jennifer Green with the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thank you for joining me for the next half hour of funny stories, quotes, and other anecdotes that we hope will add a few chuckles to your day. The Triangle Radio Reading Service is based in Raleigh, North Carolina. In honor of North Carolina, go Canes, and all things Southern, today's stories are also based on the American South. We'll find the moral, sort of, in a narrative from a North Carolinian who transplanted to New York during her college years. Then we'll recollect with David Sedaris, who was born in New York but grew up right here in Raleigh. And do I have a treat for you, listeners. We'll start off with the rantings of a writer who is not just okay, but the okayest in the South. But first, these words found on wiseoldsayings.com about Southerners from Charles Kuralt. A true Southerner will never say in 2 to 3 words what can better be said in 10 to 12. Listeners, do you ever get advice? Sure, we all do. Our first story is from writer, humorist, and novelist Sean Dietrich, who received a letter with advice about his writing style. From his book, The South's Okayest Writer, The Adventures of a Boy Columnist, published in 2018. The chapter, Friendly Advice. I'm going to give you some friendly advice, says Dan in a letter to me. I've been reading your work, he explains, and I'm going to tell you the truth, precisely like I tell my students. Your writing comes across weak. One can never reside in the ranks of great columnists by writing only about happy subjects and biscuits. Complain, Sean. You must write persuasive copy about the things you dislike in this unfair world. Don't be afraid to rant. That's what I tell students. Trust me on this. I've been writing columns for 21 years. Dan, which is not his real name, makes a point, and he knows more about writing than I do. Thus, I've decided to heed his counsel. No more biscuits. But before I start slinging complaints, I need to say a few important things. Firstly, I love trees. Bear with me, Dan. I know that was off topic, but I can't complain until I've at least mentioned how much I like trees. You ought to see the live oaks in this part of the world. Then you'd understand. And birds. I love bird calls at 6 a.m. when the world is waking. And spittoons. That might seem bizarre. I don't even chew, but I love spittoons almost as much as I love spitting. Daddy had an antique brass spittoon. It was just for show. Also, I like runt puppies, ham hocks, tomatoes staked with twine, waking up to bacon, and Bernard P. Fife. And skinks, like the skink on the porch with me now. He's blue and black, fast. I think I'll call him Edwin. Edwin, because that was the name of my server at the Mexican restaurant last night. He was rude. He botched my order and forgot my beer. Worst service I've had in years. I should have complained. Instead, I left old Ed a fat tip. I'm not wealthy, Dan, but I believe in tipping too much just for the hell of it. I once played music in a beer joint outside Atlanta, a 5-hour gig, and made 0 tips. 0. It humiliated me. The manager told me, "This'll be the last time we hire you, kid. Customers don't dig you." That hurt. After the bar closed, a waitress served me coffee for the ride home. She had old skin and blue eyes. I don't know why I remember that. "Do you know Danny's song?" she asked. I did, so I played it. "Even though we ain't got money, I'm so in love with you, honey." I don't know if the $100 bill I found in my guitar case came from her, but I believe it did. "I'm sorry, Dan. I'm supposed to be complaining, like you teach your students. Who am I to disagree? I don't claim to be a good writer. I'm just me. Maybe you're right. Ranting might be exactly what this world needs. But hell, when I start talking about trees, I get distracted. Trees do that to me. So do biscuits. Thanks for the letter. Our next story is from Jane Borden, a North Carolinian who has very fond memories of her time in New York when she was in her 20s. She learned valuable lessons, and today she imparts her wisdom. Sort of. From her book, I Totally Meant to Do That, published in 2011, the chapter, The New York Samaritan. You've never heard the story of the New York Samaritan? It begins with a prophet who smelled of urine, carried his earthly belongings in a blue plastic bag, and did beseech subway riders, "Repent, the end is nigh." A man with a briefcase approached the prophet and tried to trap him, saying snidely and with air quotes, "Master, what must I do to receive eternal life?" The prophet parted the sea of flies to answer him, "What do the scriptures say?" The yuppie answered, "Love your neighbor as thyself." "You are right," the prophet replied. "Do this, and you will live." The man wanted to justify himself, so he asked the prophet, "Who is my neighbor?" The prophet answered, "There once was a man lying half dead on a path in Brooklyn. Three people passed by him, including a lowly, impoverished writer named Jane. As the sun rose, Jane traveled the road to Brooklyn from Manhattan, where she had pimped herself as a talking head to an early morning news program that taped in Rockefeller Center, so desperate was she for the measly media fee paid by the magazine that employed her. The man lying half dead had been working all night as well, providing relief to wicked men, peddling tiny vials filled with the unholy spirit, you know, selling heroin. She had passed the man who lived in the apartment beneath hers hours earlier while he was plying his trade, and she had said unto him, 'Sup?' But he replied not, speaking only into his phone, 'Ask and ye shall receive in exchange for $20. Jane had every reason to distrust this man, for he had persecuted her. One afternoon, while she washed laundry, he picked her lock and stole the new portable electronic computing device that he knew was near the front door, because he'd just been upstairs to ask if the exterminator had come. And seriously, there was no sign of breaking and entering, so it was definitely an inside job. And twice she had returned home to find police vehicles flashing lights the colors of wine and sky, because he had been out turning the other cheek until his eyes did swell and his nose did break. But man, ye should have seen the other guy. Alas, Jane was too poor to find new dwellings, for she had spent her last pennies, in a most desperate moment, on a super lotto ticket. So she remained in the haze of his hemp and halo parties, brushing past the thieves and lepers he invited to their stoop. And lo, how his phone would ring through the night, and lo, how and loud how the dragon chasers would shout from the street, "Yo, Justin, I know you're there." Verily, Jane had every reason to despise the neighbor, yet her heart was filled with pity for his alcoholic, abusive parents were both locked behind the bars of the state, which is why her saint of a landlady took him in off the street in the first place. Then again, she also had gout, so neither had her path been lit by wise decisions. And it then happened that while approaching India Street, on the road from 30 Rock to her bed, Jane did encounter two lums of the hood, fleeing the building, who spake not to her and scurried toward the rising sun. And lo, upon ascending her stairs, she did rediscover Justin, her neighbor, lying half dead on the second floor landing in the middle of her path. Where he once had conducted business, now he lay prostrate, stripped of his raiment, shaking as a man filled with evil spirits. In his pallid skin his eyes did roll, and his tongue did loll, and his mouth did froth. Jane saw that he was tweaking, and saw that it was bad. He looked to her, slowly raised his arm, grunted with great effort, and reached his hand toward her in need and in terror. Gazing down upon his face, Jane said only, "Ew," then lifted her foot, stepped over him, and continued up the stairs. Concluding with his tale, the prophet asked the lawyer, "Which now of these three was neighbor unto him?" The lawyer replied, "I think they're all assholes." And the prophet said unto him, "Exactly. This is New York, you fool. Also, the aliens are trying to eat me because my hands are made of crackers. And I took your wallet." Next up, David Sedaris tells us about his capture during a geography lesson in fifth grade that turned out to be the start of his speech therapy. From his book, Me Talk Pretty One Day, published in 2000, excerpts from the chapter, Go Carolina. Anyone who watches even the slightest amount of TV is familiar with this scene. An agent knocks on the door of some seemingly ordinary home or office. The door opens, and the person holding the knob is asked to identify himself. The agent then says, "I'm going to ask you to come with me." They're always remarkably calm, these agents. If asked, "Why do I need to go anywhere with you?" they'll straighten their shirt cuffs or idly brush stray hairs from the sleeves of their sports coat and say, "Oh, I think we both know why." The suspect then chooses between doing things the hard way and doing things the easy way, and the scene ends with either gunfire or the gentlemanly application of handcuffs. Occasionally, it's a case of mistaken identity, but most often, the suspect knows why he's being taken. It seems he's been expecting this to happen. The anticipation has ruled his life, and now, finally, the wait is over. You're sometimes led to believe that this person is actually relieved, but I've never bought it. Though it probably has its moments, the average day spent in hiding is bound to beat the average day spent in prison. The agent came for me during a geography lesson. She entered the room and nodded at my fifth grade teacher, who stood frowning at a map of Europe. What would needle me later was the realization that this had all been prearranged. My capture had been scheduled to go down at exactly 2:30 on a Thursday afternoon. The agent would be wearing a dun-colored blazer over a red-knit turtleneck, her heels sensibly low in case the subject should attempt a quick getaway. "David," the teacher said, "this is Miss Sampson, and she'd like you to go with her now." No one else had been called, so why me? I ran down a list of recent crimes, looking for a conviction that might stick. Setting fire to a reportedly flame-proof Halloween costume, stealing a set of barbecue tongs from an unguarded patio, altering the word "hit" on a list of rules posted on the gymnasium door. Never did it occur to me that I might be innocent. "You might want to take your books with you," the teacher said, "and your jacket. You probably won't be back before the bell rings." Although she seemed old at the time, the agent was most likely fresh out of college. She walked beside me and asked what appeared to be an innocent and unrelated question. "So, which do you like better, State or Carolina?" She was referring to the athletic rivalry between the Triangle area's two largest universities. Those who cared about such things tended to express their allegiance by wearing either Tar Heel powder blue or Wolfpack red, two colors that managed to look good on no one. The question of team preference was common in our part of North Carolina, and the answer supposedly spoke volumes about the kind of person you either were or hoped to become. I had no interest in football or basketball, but had learned it was best to pretend otherwise. If a boy didn't care for barbecued chicken or potato chips, people would accept it as a matter of personal taste, saying, "Oh, well, I guess it takes all kinds." You could turn up your nose at the president, or Coke, or even God, but there were names for boys who didn't like sports. When the subject came up, I found it best to ask which team my questioner preferred. Then I'd say, "Really? Me too." asked by the agent which team I supported, I took my cue from her red turtleneck and told her that I was for state. Definitely state. State all the way. It was an answer I would regret for years to come. State, did you say? The agent asked. Yes, state. They're the greatest. I see. She led me through an unmarked door near the principal's office into a small windowless room furnished with two facing desks. It was the kind of room where you'd grill someone until they snapped, the kind frequently painted so as to cover the blood stains. She gestured toward what was to become my regular seat, then continued her line of questioning. And what exactly are they, state and Carolina? Colleges? Universities? She opened a file on her desk, saying, Yes, you're right. Your answers are correct, but you're saying them incorrectly. You're telling me that they're colleges and universities, when actually they're colleges and universities. You're giving me a th sound instead of a nice, clear S. It was the first battle of my war against the letter S, and I was determined to dig my foxhole before the sun went down. According to Agent Sampson, a speech-certified speech therapist, or a state-certified speech therapist, my S was sibilant, meaning that I lisped. This was not news to me. Our goal is to work together until eventually you can speak correctly, Agent Sampson said. She made a great show of enunciating her own sparkling S's, and the effect was profoundly irritating. I'm trying to help you, but the longer you play these little games, the longer this is going to take. The woman spoke with a heavy Western North Carolina accent, which I used to discredit her authority. Here was a person for whom the word pen had two syllables. Her people undoubtedly drank from clay jugs and hollered for Paul when the victuals were ready. So who was she to advise me on anything? Over the coming years, I would find a crack in each of the therapists sent to train what Miss Sampson now defined as my lazy tongue. That's its problem, she said. It's just plain lazy. My therapy sessions were scheduled for every Thursday at 2:30, and with the exception of my mother, I discussed them with no one. The word therapy suggested a profound failure on my part. Mental patients had therapy. Normal people did not. I didn't see my sessions as the sort of thing that one would want to advertise, but as my teacher liked to say, I guess it takes all kinds. Whereas my goal was to keep a secret, hers was to inform the entire class. If I got up from my seat at 2:25, she'd say, Sit back down, David. You've still got 5 minutes before your speech therapy session. If I remained seated until 2:27, she'd say, David, don't forget you have a speech therapy session at 2:30. On the days I was absent, I imagined she addressed the room, saying, David's not here today, but if he were, he'd have a speech therapy session at 2:30. My sessions varied from week to week. Sometimes I'd spend the half hour parroting whatever Miss Sampson had to say. We'd occasionally pass the time examining charts on tongue position or reading childish S-laden texts recounting the adventures of seals or settlers named Sassy or Samuel. On the worst of days, she'd haul out a tape recorder and show me just how much progress I was failing to make. My speech therapist's name is Miss Chrissy Sampson. She'd hand me the microphone and lean back with her arms crossed. Go ahead, say it. I want you to hear what you sound like. She was in love with the sound of her own name and seemed to view my speech impediment as a personal assault. If I wanted to spend the rest of my life as David Thedareth, then so be it. She, however, was going to be called Miss Chrissy Sampson. Had her name included no S's, she probably would have bypassed a career in therapy and devoted herself to yanking out healthy molars or performing unwanted clitoridectomies on the schoolgirls of Africa. Such was her personality. Oh, come on, my mother would say. I'm sure she's not that bad. Give her a break. The girl's just trying to do her job. Miss Chrissy instructed me, when forming an S, to position the tip of my tongue against the rear of my top teeth, right against the gum line. The effect produced a sound not unlike that of a tire releasing air. It was awkward and strange sounding, and elicited much more attention than the original lisp. I failed to see the hissy S as a solution to the problem, and continued to talk normally, at least at home, where my lazy tongue fell upon equally lazy ears. At school, where every teacher was a potential spy, I tried to avoid an S sound whenever possible. Yes became correct, or a military affirmative. Please became with your kind permission, and questions were pleaded rather than asked. After a few weeks of what she called endless pestering, and what I called repeated badgering, my mother bought me a pocket thesaurus, which provided me with S-free alternatives to just about everything. I consulted the book both at home in my room, and at the Daily Learning Academy, other people called our school. Agent Sampson was not amused when I began referring to her as an articulation coach, but the majority of my teachers were delighted. "What a nice vocabulary," they said. "My goodness, such big words." Plurals presented a considerable problem, but I worked around them as best I could. Rivers, for example, became either a river or two, or many a river. Possessives were a similar headache, and it was easier to say nothing than to announce that the left hand and the right hand glove of Janet had fallen to the floor. After all the compliments I had received on my improved vocabulary, it seemed prudent to lie low and keep my mouth shut. I didn't want anyone thinking I was trying to be a pet of the teacher. It turned out that Agent Sampson was something along the lines of a circuit court speech therapist. She spent 4 months at our school and then moved on to another. Our last meeting was held the day before school let out for Christmas. My classrooms were all decorated, the halls, everything but her office, which remained as bare as ever. I was expecting a regular half hour of Sassy the Seal, and was delighted to find her packing up her tape recorder. "I thought that this afternoon we might let loose and have a party, you and I. How does that sound?" She reached into her desk drawer and withdrew a festive tin of cookies. "Here, have one. I made them myself from scratch, and boy was it a mess. Do you ever make cookies?" I lied, saying that no, I never had. "Well, it's hard work," she said, "especially if you don't have a mixer." It was unlike Agent Sampson to speak so casually and awkward to sit in the hot little room pretending to have a normal conversation. "So," she said, "what are your plans for the holidays?" "Well, I usually remain here and, you know, open a gift from my family." "Only one?" she asked. "Maybe 8 or 10. "Never 6 or 7? "Rarely," I said. "And what do you do on December 31st, New Year's Eve?" "On the final day of the year, we take down the pine tree in our living room and eat marine life." "You're pretty good at avoiding those S's," she said. "I have to hand it to you. You're tougher than most." I thought she would continue to trying to trip me up, but instead she talked about her own holiday plans. "It's pretty hard with my fiancé in Vietnam," she said. "Last year, we went up to see his folks in Roanoke, but this year I'll spend Christmas with my grandmother outside of Asheville. My parents will come, and we'll all try our best to have a good time. I'll eat some turkey and go to church, and then the next day, a friend and I will drive down to Jacksonville to watch Florida play Tennessee in the Gator Bowl." I couldn't imagine anything worse than driving down to Florida to watch a football game, but I pretended to be impressed. "Wow, that ought to be eventful." "I was in Memphis last year when NC State whooped Georgia 14-7 in the Liberty Bowl," she said. "And next year, I don't care who's playing, but I want to be sitting front row center at the Tangerine Bowl. Have you ever been to Orlando? It's a super fun place. If my future husband can find a job in his field, We're hoping to move down there within a year or two. Me living in Florida. I bet that would make you happy, wouldn't it? I didn't quite know how to respond. Who was this College Bowl fanatic with no mixer and a fiancé in Vietnam? And why had she taken so long to reveal herself? Here I'd thought of her as a cold-blooded agent, when she was really nothing but a slightly dopey, inexperienced speech teacher. She wasn't a bad person, Miss Sampson, but her timing was off. She should have acted friendly at the beginning of the year, instead of waiting until now, when all I could do was feel sorry for her. I tried my best to work with you and the others, but sometimes a person's best just isn't good enough. She took another cookie and turned it over in her hands. I really wanted to prove myself and make a difference in people's lives, but it's hard to do your job when you're met with so much resistance. My students don't like me, and I guess that's just the way it is. What can I say? As a speech teacher, I'm a complete failure. She moved her hands toward her face, and I thought that she might start to cry. Hey, look, I said. I'm Thawy. Ha ha, she said. I got you. She laughed much more than she needed to, and was still at it when she signed the form recommending me for the following year's speech therapy program. Sorry, indeed. You've got some work ahead of you, mister. I related the story to my mother, who got a huge kick out of it. You've got to admit that you really are a sucker, she said. I agreed, but because none of my speech classes ever made a difference, I still prefer to use the word chump. My dear Southerner listeners, we have just enough time for a list of the South's 20 seasons, found on southernthing.com. The South's 20 seasons: hunting, winter, pollen, winter, tornado, so much pollen, one more winter, tornado, attack of the mosquitoes, summer, more summer, even more summer. Please, Lord, make this summer end. Football, tornado, fall. Just kidding. Here's some more summer. Winter, Christmas, maybe one more summer. I'm Jennifer Green with the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Join me again next month for That's a Laugh. I'll be back on the fourth Tuesday of every month, and I hope you'll listen again next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. Just click on the podcast link under the listen bar at the top of the homepage. And remember, you can now listen to TRRS on Amazon Echo. Simply say, Alexa, play Triangle Radio Reading Service, and you will hear broadcasts instantly. Are you enjoying the show? We'd love to hear from you. Please call us with any questions, requests, or other comments about this or any of your TRRS programs at 919-832-5138. That number, one more time, is 919-832-5138.